Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Army General Lloyd Austin, the commander of U.S. military forces in the Middle East, told reporters this morning that it is highly possible that the Syrian city of Kobani could fall to ISIS, which has made seizing Kobani its main effort. U.S. airstrikes against ISIS increased this week. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says more than 660 people have been killed since the ISIS offensive on Kobani began. The group notes that the overall death toll could be twice that estimate because of what it called extreme secrecy about casualties from both sides. Joining us to talk about media coverage of this complex situation is Alexander Christie Miller, freelance journalist based in Istanbul. Alexander writes for the Times of London, the Christian Science Monitor, and Newsweek, and he joins us from Istanbul. Hi, Alexander. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Hi, great to have you. And we're also joined by Reese Ehrlich, an award-winning freelance foreign correspondent who has traveled widely across the Middle East. Reese is the author of four books, including his latest, Inside Syria, the backstory of their civil war and what the world can expect. And Reese joins me here in studio. Hi, Reese. Thanks
Good
for
morning.
Coming in. Great to have you. So as we always do, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So Reese, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
As frequent listeners to this show know, I'm a strong critic of the New York Times, and that's reflected in my book Inside Syria as well. But I think this week they got it right. There was a story a couple days ago about the fact that there were leftover chemical weapons in Iraq that were being used by rebel groups, and were American soldiers came across them. In some cases, the munitions were exploded, and the whole issue was hushed up by the military, and the injuries to the soldiers was never reported and never revealed until this article came out. So they did a lot of investigative reporting. And to their credit, they emphasized that this was not the infamous weapons of mass destruction that Bush had claimed, but in fact, leftover chemical artillery warheads from the Iran-Iraq war that had simply been left to rot.
Will there be any ramifications for this? What did the people quoted say in the piece?
Well, it'll be, for sure, it's caused a lot of hubbub in the other media. It's been widely reported elsewhere as well. Investigations are underfoot, et cetera, whether anybody has ever held responsible for it, that's another question.
All right, thank you for that. And what about you, Alexander? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, one publication which has been covering things particularly well in terms of what's happening in Kobani in the past couple of weeks has been Bloomberg. Their reporter, Celtan Hacıoğlu, has been down on the border and going around the Kurdish area of Turkey, and he had a very interesting piece out today, which was looking at obviously there's half the sort of foreign press corps is down on the border, and he did something which no one else has done, which is he went to the towns about 20 kilometers to the east and west of Kobani, both of which have been controlled by the Islamic State for a long time. A lot of the media coverage has been to suggest that if Kobani falls, it means that Turkey will have ISIS as a neighbor for the first time, whereas in fact ISIS has been Turkey's neighbor for quite some time. And what he was getting from that, because obviously there are a lot of family ties on the towns either side of the border, was that the Turks living adjacent to ISIS, speaking to their families on the other side, were saying that ISIS had restored order, and yes, they were beheading people and they were cutting people's hands off for crimes, but they preferred it to the time when the Syrian rebels, the more moderate Syrian rebels, were in control, because it was more chaotic. There was Assad regime bombing and this kind of thing. And it was an interesting counterpoint to a lot of the coverage that we've seen of this. Obviously, not that uh, not to imply that that they weren't critical, but it was an interesting different perspective, I thought.
Hmm. Well, and Alexander, I mean, you report for the Times of London, the Christian Science Monitor, and Newsweek, and Kobani is leading headlines here in the United States. It's leading all of the Sunday shows. What are your thoughts overall on how this is being reported, and why do you think this Bloomberg piece stood out? I mean, you explained a little bit, but if you can elaborate a bit.
Well, I think that the Bloomberg piece just stuck out to me because it helps to illuminate why Turkey isn't as scared by ISIS as the West is. Rightly or wrongly, Turkey doesn't see ISIS as the kind of terrible public enemy number one that the West does, and they've been sitting with ISIS on their border for some time, and they're quite comfortable with it. I mean, I think there are a lot of my opinion would be that that's a very short-sighted perspective, but that's one thing which helps to explain the question which editors have been asking me again and again, which is why isn't Turkey doing more to help Kobani?
Hmm.
And in terms of the sort of wider issues, observations regarding generally the foreign coverage, one thing which is being said again and again, and which needs to be sort of clarified, is that people see these pictures of Turkish tanks lined up on the border, and they see ISIS, defeating the Kurds in Kobani or encircling the Kurds in Kobani. And they say, well, why isn't Turkey intervening? And it's almost turned into people assuming that Turkey is being called to intervene. In fact, no one is calling for Turkey to send its troops into Syria to directly rescue the Kurds there. In fact, the Turks raised this suggestion. They said themselves, without a ground invasion, Kobani will fall. But in fact, what they're being asked to do by the Kurds themselves is to create a corridor so that the Kurds can be allowed to reinforce themselves. And that difference is important, I think, because it really would be quite unreasonable to expect Turkey to send in ground troops to fight ISIS, given that it shares a 900-kilometer border with Syria. It's very, very exposed to whatever happens in the Syrian civil war.
Alexander, I had a question for you. This is Reese Ehrlich. Isn't part of the problem the underlying political issues that the Turkish government is very fearful of the PKK-affiliated group in Kobani that's are the main fighters, that is, the affiliated with the Kurdistan Workers Party, and Turkey is reluctant to see them emerge victorious?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, that's one of Turkey's main fears in regards to the Syrian civil war, is that the PYD, which is the Syrian affiliate of the PKK, which has fought a 30-year insurgency in Turkey, is going to end up being empowered, and that the Kurds will create a autonomous area of self-rule in Syria. This is really what they don't want to see that happen, and so there's very strong, both I think, popular pressure and very strong thinking within the government that, in some ways, they're not going to help out these guys who they see as their number one security threat.
Alexander Christie Miller is a freelance journalist based in Istanbul, and Reese Ehrlich is an award-winning freelance correspondent. His latest book is Inside Syria, and Alexander will be with us for about 15 more minutes. So if you have any questions about what is happening in Turkey, this is fairly complex, and Reese, I wanted to ask you about this in a minute, but if you have any questions about the media coverage that you're seeing or comments, Kobani is just getting so many headlines in the U.S. press. What are your thoughts on that? What do you learning from the media? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Reese, you've been traveling, giving talks about your new book, Inside Syria, and you said that a lot of people are kind of confused because this is such a complex issue. So what do you think are some of the main points that need to be explained so we can understand what exactly is happening?
Well, the number one question that I get is, oh my God, isn't the Islamic State the most evil group that we've seen in a long time? And if they succeed, that's going to mean a disaster, and they're going to come, next step is to come to here and come to Europe with their terrorist attacks. And I think you have to take a step back. Yes, the Islamic State is an evil war criminal group. They're definitely a threat to parts of Syria and Iraq, but they're no more a threat to the United States or Europe than Al-Qaeda or some of these other groups that have carried out occasional terrorist attacks. And in fact, there's evidence to show they're not particularly focused and were not particularly focused on the U.S. until the U.S. started its bombing campaign. So it's the hype, it's the terrorist of the week, and the fact that it's not a serious threat is indicated by Obama himself, because when he started the bombing of Syria, he said, oh, no, the Islamic State's not that dangerous, but there's this new group that you have to be very, very worried about, the Kobani, a group which has been not mentioned again since. So the bombing campaign that's going on should be held in great skepticism. If they keep switching the reasons for the new war, they can't even agree on that. That's the number one point of confusion.
And Alexander, what are your thoughts on that? You just heard that Reese is traveling around the Bay Area, and people are very concerned about ISIS and whether or not they'll make it their way to Europe or the United States. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I'm sure Reese will know better than me, but I mean, my understanding is that the kind of the ideological development from Al Qaeda to ISIS, and obviously, you know, ISIS has broken with Al Qaeda, is that Al Qaeda was focusing on the enemy far away, the distant enemy, i.e., the West, and ISIS is much more concerned about expanding within the Middle East. You know, if I was a Syrian or if I was an Iraqi, I would probably be a lot more, I would be very scared of ISIS, or even as a journalist working in Turkey, to be honest. You know, it sort of keeps me awake at night thinking about them. But in terms of a threat to people in America, you know, their priority is territorial expansion within the Middle East. And when you look at what they can actually do, I mean, they've been expanding within two, you know, almost verging on failed states, one failed state and one something heading towards a failed state, and the armies they're fighting against aren't the big regional powers. I mean, they're very much, I think, constrained in terms of how far they could expand. Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to what Reese says there.
And also, is there any way to know how many people are fleeing or have fled because of ISIS?
I don't have any good information on that, actually. I mean, it's I think it depends heavily on ethnicity and religion. I mean, you know, if you're a Shiite Muslim, or if you're, obviously, you know, there's been a lot of coverage about the Yazidis. If you're non-Muslim, then you will have no place under ISIS, you know, realistically. But I mean, I've seen some reporting suggesting that Sunni Muslims in the areas that ISIS control have actually moved back to Turkey to the areas they control, because they provide greater stability, basically, than the rebel factions.
It's very difficult to estimate how many people have fled, because some of them are internally displaced, that is, moving from one part of Iraq to another, and others have become refugees, like the folks from Kobani going into Turkey. So the estimates of Yazidis were in the tens of thousands that took place in August when I was there in northern Iraq. I've seen figures of 150,000 Syrians, mostly Kurds, fleeing into Turkey. Mm-hmm. But frankly, I don't know that anybody can say with certainty how many.
We've seen reports, 200,000 from Kobani alone, about 1.8 million in Iraq. And aren't Kurds in Kobani having a hard time getting into Turkey? Aren't they being turned away at the border in many cases? Alexander?
Well, refugees haven't been turned away from the border. I mean, what's been happening in the past few days is that Turkey has begun. Turkey said about or Turkish officials said about about a week ago now, they said, as far as we're concerned, there aren't any citizens, civilians left in Kobani. They're all fighters. Therefore, we will start screening men coming from Kobani and fingerprinting them and that kind of stuff. So you have seen sort of men being detained, and I know there have been a few instances recently in which injured fighters have been left at the border and not allowed to cross and then died as a result. Turkey's admitted 180,000, refugees from Kobani now. There are still people crossing and coming over. They're not really closing their doors exactly.
That is Alexander Christie Miller, a journalist based in Istanbul who writes for The Times of London, The Christian Science Monitor, and Newsweek. And Reese Ehrlich is an award-winning freelance foreign correspondent who's traveled widely across the Middle East. His latest book is Inside Syria, the backstory of their civil war and what the world can expect. And let's hear from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for a good program. I have a couple of questions. It has to do with the attitude of the Erdogan government vis-à-vis the Kurds. I thought that at one point this administration had taken a more conciliatory posture vis-à-vis the Kurds within Iraq, within Turkey. And now I'm hearing that things are not that clear-cut. Has there been a change from the perspective of the government in Turkey? And my second question has to do with that coalition that has been put together at the behest of the American government to counter ISIS's activities in the Middle East, in the Levant, as some people put it. Would you comment on that? I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that.
Well, Alexander's in I have some opinions, but Alexander's in Istanbul.
I'll take number one if you want, and sure. You can take number two. Yes, I mean, the Erdogan government has done more than any of its predecessors to improve the condition of Turkey's Kurds. They've introduced laws that have lifted restrictions on education in Kurdish. They've launched a Kurdish news channel, or television channel. And since 2011, they've been conducting a peace process. Since March last year, they've been conducting a peace process with the PKK. It's really, what's happening in Kobani is really the main reason why this is now breaking down. Fundamentally, it's an enormous ask of Turkey to expect it to assist a fighting organization which it regards as a terrorist group and which it regards as its main security threat. You know, it's really a red line for Turkey's leaders. At the same time, Kobani resonates extraordinarily with Turkey's Kurds. They regard it as part of their own homeland. And a huge number of Turkish Kurds are fighting in Kobani and dying in Kobani. And there's a deep-seated belief here, which is very hard to substantiate, and which I don't really believe personally, but that Turkey has been assisting ISIS. And so really these two sides have come together, these two opposing views of the situation have come together, and the situation in Kobani has made this good work that the Erdogan government has done effectively break down. And it's very easy for the Turkish government and almost necessary for it at times like this to launch into anti-Kurdish rhetoric, because a large proportion of the Turkish population remains very hostile to the Kurds and especially to the PKK.
As to the question that was asked about the coalition, mm-hmm. The current coalition is no more real than the coalition of the willing was in the outset of the 2003 attack on Iraq and occupation. The U.S. is the main political, military, economic force. It's paying for the war. It's found a few people to agree, a few photo ops, a Saudi woman pilot we saw one time. But the the coalition itself is fragile, to say the least. And a good example is Turkey, which the U.S. keeps hyping the fact that Turkey is part of the coalition and they're on board for the fight. They're allowing the U.S. flights out of the key military base and so on. The Turks say, wait a minute, that's an exaggeration. Yes, we don't like the Islamic State, but we think the PKK-affiliated group is just as bad, and Assad is just as bad. And it shows you the internal contradictions within that coalition are going to play out in the future and be reveal themselves to be quite damaging.
Thank you for calling, Max. And Alexander, how is this coalition being covered in Turkey? And also, how are U.S. strikes being covered in Turkey?
Well, not very favorably is the answer. I mean, the Erdogan himself the other day made a very, very strident speech in which he said that the West is bombing the Middle East not for peace but for petrol, and a very large section of the Turkish press takes its cue from what he said. And so there's a tremendous amount of nationalist indignation in Turkey at the moment because they feel like America is trying to railroad them into another ill-thought-out, ill-advised military venture into the Middle East. Remember, they didn't take part in the Iraq 2003 invasion despite intense pressure. And I think they felt pretty vindicated for not doing that. And there's a similar mood at the moment. I mean, I think that the Turkish government itself wants to work out an arrangement with the U.S. because they want to see Assad toppled. They want to they want to work with the U.S. in Syria genuinely, but there's a phenomenal amount of anger at the idea that they're being forced into an enterprise which hasn't been particularly well thought out.
What about sentiment in Turkey? What are you hearing from people on the ground? Do they support? Do they want to go after ISIS? What are their thoughts on the U.S.? I mean, you mentioned it briefly, but I think you were talking about the government. What are you hearing from the people?
Well, a majority of Turks, I mean, in terms of opinion polls and stuff, a majority of Turks support the action against ISIS. I mean, there's, on the other hand, though, sentiment has changed as this clash in Kobani has unfolded. And particularly since the very violent riots that have occurred here in the past, they've finished now, but last week, there were the most violent protests and riots that Turkey's seen in certainly more than a decade. 37 people died, and it was the Kurds rioting against the government's inaction over Kobani. And that's created a very strong counter-reaction among many Turks who are almost more favorably disposed now to the Islamic State or are more ambivalent about the idea of getting involved in it than perhaps they were in the past. I've been surprised at the amount of, on social media and that sort of thing, the amount of support that I've seen from Turks for ISIS, which I never really saw before. I think it remains an organization that they're not they don't feel much affinity for, but it's tensions are so high here at the moment.
Alexander, I know we have to let you go soon, but in like 30 seconds, what explains that support?
Well, essentially, ISIS is a Sunni organization, Sunni Muslim organization in a sectarian war in the Middle East, and the majority of Turkey's population is Sunni, and there's a percentage of those who identify very strongly with these Sunni forces who are fighting against, as they perceive it, oppression by other groups, both in Syria and Iraq. There's a degree of sectarian solidarity. A part of it, certainly.
All right. Well, Alexander, thank you so much for joining us. Alexander Christie Miller writes for The Times of London and the Christian Science Monitor in Istanbul. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, a program that relies on engaged listeners
We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-8255. Or you can send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will continue our discussion about how the pro-choice movement should reframe the abortion debate. We got so many calls and emails when we did that show earlier this week, so we thought we would continue the conversation. The Nation columnist Katha Pollitt will join us in studio to talk about her new book, Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights. And then on Tuesday, we will continue our election coverage by having a debate about California Proposition 47. And Wednesday, we'll have a conversation with filmmaker Laura Poitras about the new film Citizen 4, which is about Edward Snowden. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And we are talking about what is happening in the Middle East, in Turkey and in Syria and ISIS, and this complex issue with Rhys Erlich. He's an award-winning freelance foreign correspondent who's traveled widely across the Middle East. He's the author of four books, including his latest, Inside Syria, The Backstory of Their Civil War and What the World Can Expect. And Rhys will be at an event tonight, a very special event. He'll be with a group of musicians who will come together to pay tribute to the people of Syria. This is at the Freight and Salvage 2020 Addison in Berkeley. It starts at 8 o'clock, and you can find more information at the Freight, FREIGHT.org. And Rhys, this is going to be a really special event.
Yes, people who just were listening to the break music was an oud, and the oud will change your mood for sure.
It's a beautiful instrument.
It is. It's an Arabic lute. So what will happen is I'm getting together with local jazz musicians, Larry Vukovic, Vince Delgado, and others. They're going to rearrange Arabic music in a jazz mode and then play some jazz tunes on Arabic instruments.
Now, where have you traveled just in the last year in the Middle East?
Oh, in the Middle East, I was in Israel and the Golan Heights and in Syria and northern Iraq.
Because this issue is so complex and there are so many players involved, when you talk about these issues, like tonight, for example, you're going to be speaking, how do you explain this to people? Because you said you've been at Stanford, you've been at a couple other places, and you said there's a lot of confusion out there.
Well, I think there's several levels to it. First of all, it is very confusing, and people tend to get very pessimistic when they hear, oh, my God, there's yet another war, another attack, or another terrorist group. And then partly it's because there's a lot of intentional confusion spread in the form of propaganda out of Washington and then duly set on the conveyor belt through the major media and out to us. So why are we more worried about the Islamic State and have to possibly send in boots on the ground when the Boko Haram, another extremist group in Nigeria, kidnaps teenage girls and sells them into sex slavery? But nobody's talking about invading Nigeria. So there are crises and there are crises. And I think in the previous discussion, you have to look at oil, that Iraq and Kurdistan have huge reserves of oil, which the U.S. wants to control wherever possible. Syria has a key location, border key countries in the area, not so much oil, but the potential of a U.S. pro-U.S. government in Damascus is huge, and military bases. The U.S. wants to expand its military might in the region. So if you understand that those are the real reasons, then all of the concerns about human rights and why is this crisis such a huge one, whereas that other crisis isn't, then it all comes into focus.
You mentioned the propaganda machine coming out of the Pentagon. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, we're in the early stages of the war right now, where we see these videos of missiles coming in and hitting a target, and we're told that it came in, destroyed an enemy target with no civilian casualties. And then when reporters raise the fact that there were, in fact, civilian casualties, the Pentagon says, well, we have no information on that, which is a non-denial denial. And they never seem to investigate to find out if civilians really were killed. So that's one area that we get it. The other is that somehow the people operating in Syria and Iraq right now are even super bad, super predators, super terrorists that requires us to do something. And so the debate in Washington is between those who want to see humanitarian intervention and those who want to see, which would say be limited to airstrikes, and those who want to introduce troops, larger numbers of troops, because we already have troops in the area. And that's a very narrow debate, as Alexander is explaining about Turkey, the people in Turkey, the people in the region. There's many who don't want to see any intervention whatsoever, but that's off the table.
What about the brutal suppression we saw of the protests in Syria? Why doesn't that get much attention anymore?
Well, partly because, you mean you're talking about by the Assad government?
Yes.
Yeah. Partly because it's old news. It goes on all the time. It's routine. Partly because we're now fighting the bigger enemy, the Islamic State. And although the Obama administration denies it, if you're supporting one group, if you're opposing one group, you're supporting another. And right now, the U.S. is in a tacit alliance with Assad against because we're bombing the Islamic State. So there's plenty of repression going on. There's still sieges of various towns. There's a Palestinian area of Damascus called Yarmouk that has been fighting the Assad government and the pro-Assad forces there, basically laying siege and starving people out. But we hear nothing about that, either from the Pentagon or from the major media, partly because it's hard to get in there and report on it,
right,
and partly because it doesn't fit the current parameters.
So how are the people actually dealing with this? Because the Assad government, they're still killing civilians and the rebels, right? I mean, so can you give us an update on that? And as you said, it's hard to get in Syria. How should this be covered by the media?
Well, the some reporters are able to get in this legally through Damascus. Many others are reporting from Beirut, which is close, but of course not in. And then you make phone calls in. And granted, I've been in this situation, and it's quite difficult because there's nothing, no substitute for being there to be able to interview people firsthand and get your information. But you do as best you can now with Skype and emails and text messages and so on, and develop an array of sources to give you accurate information. The sieges continue, and outside the suburbs of Damascus, where basically the rebels have significant influence or control, and the government's policy is to starve out the civilians and then hopefully be able to defeat the rebels militarily. So you're seeing huge hundreds of thousands, indeed millions of displaced people within Syria as a result of the Assad policies.
Reese Ehrlich is an award-winning freelance foreign correspondent. His latest book is Inside Syria, the backstory of their civil war and what the world can expect. He'll be joining musicians tonight at the Freight and Salvage to pay tribute to the people of Syria. The Freight is at 2020 Addison in Berkeley, and the event starts at 8 p.m. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions for Reese about what he has seen, he's been to Syria and northern Iraq in the last year. And also, because Kobani is just getting so much attention in the United States press, what are you learning about it? And what questions do you have? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. Also, what do you think about the information that we are getting from the Pentagon and the White House on this and how the media are reporting on that? Let's go to Frank in San Francisco. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Thank you. My questions concern the Iraqi army, referring to a news story I heard that the United States military was training a reconstituted Iraqi army to replace the one that disappeared recently. I'd like to know, during the time that Saddam was in power, what was the makeup of the army, Sunni versus Shiite, and how does that compare to the army that took its place after the U.S. overthrew Saddam, and what was the role of the Iraqi army while the Maliki government was using Shiite militias to oppress the Sunnis?
Good question. Under Saddam Hussein, who of course was a Sunni, Sunnis are the minority in Iraq, and his officer corps and the key personnel in the army were Sunni, and they were seen as an oppressive institution against the Shia. When the U.S. occupied in Iraq in 2003, it dissolved the army, and one of the biggest mistakes that the U.S. made of among many. And so you suddenly had tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of soldiers trained and armed with no jobs, no income, and many of them turned and became rebels of one kind or another against the U.S. occupation. Maliki is a Shia, represents a Shia party, and they built up the new army with Shia leadership, and not only that, but sectarian views supporting the Shia and opposing the Sunni, which is at the core of the current problem. So basically the old Iraqi army collapsed in the face of this most recent Islamic State offensive in July, and continuing down to today. They're now within, I think, 10 miles of the Baghdad airport. So it's not good. And, of course, the U.S. says it's going to retrain. They're going to focus on key elite troops and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, they did it for 10 years when they completely occupied and controlled the country, and it didn't work. And it didn't work because training is more than how to shoot this rifle or aim this mortar. It's political questions. And the Shia army, the army in Iraq, remains loyal to the Shia parties, and that's going to undermine its efforts to ally with Sunni.
How do you assess U.S. policy in Iraq at this point?
One more disaster. We're doubling down on a policy that failed. We should have never invaded in 2003. What happened was predictable. Norman Solomon and I wrote a book at the time in which, and it wasn't because we were fortune tellers, but because the whole anti-war movement said this is a disastrous party, it's going to fracture policy. And the U.S. is directly responsible for the existence of the Islamic State.
Well, and that, I'm glad you brought that up, because Tim Orengo, Baghdad bureau chief of the New York Times, was on Fresh Air a couple of weeks ago, and this is not really getting much attention. Terry Gross said, do you think ISIS would have existed if not for the American invasion of Iraq? And Tim Orengo said, no, absolutely not.
Well, good for him. I'm glad he spoke the truth on that one, because there were no terrorist groups of this kind in Iraq or in Syria prior to the U.S. invasion of 2003. When the U.S. occupied the country, it angered most Iraqis. There were rebellions, but the Sunni, a portion of them, became supporters of a group that was a predecessor to today's Islamic State. And then later they went across the border into Syria, where they found, again, some support. So had the U.S. not overthrown Saddam, we'd be looking at a very different world.
Do you think that this is an important angle, and why isn't it getting more attention?
Sure. The U.S. government wants to make sure we have no sense of history. Everything that happens now suddenly emerged out of nowhere. And not only that, they're all unconnected. So what's going on in Iraq and Syria today is unconnected to the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, which is unconnected to the Iranian dispute over nuclear power, et cetera, et cetera. But for people in the region, these things are all interconnected, and one leads to another, and you can't separate them. But the American sense of history goes back as far as last month.
Well, thank you for calling in, Frank, and you can join us at 866-798-8255 with Reese Ehrlich, an award-winning freelance foreign correspondent. His latest book is Inside Syria, the Backstory of Their Civil War and What the World Can Expect. Let's go next to Jeanette in San Francisco. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm so glad to hear Reese on the line pointing out these discrepancies in what we're being led to believe once again and what's actually happening in the region, just like a rerun of Iraq. I wanted to announce that Dennis Kucinich has been commenting about a lot of this through the late summer and early fall. According to his recent post, U.S. intervention led to the militant takeover. The occupation of Iraq triggered the jihadists there. And the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, and Jordan funded ISIS's predecessors. And, you know, really, just like what your other guest was saying, and the sense of the Turks, is that the real reason for bombing Syria is to dominate the oil and to wrest control away from ISIS. So Denis Kucinich is touring between 9/11 and 11/11 right now, and he will be in San Francisco this weekend, and he'll actually be at a free event at the Women's Building at 3 p.m. And
on what day?
Hopefully, this is Sunday, on Sunday, October 19th.
Okay.
And he's also going to be doing a 5K race in the morning at Lake Merced, and it's all part of his tour. If you look up hashtag 91, or, you know, the pound sign, 911, lowercase T-O, 1111, which is 9/11 means terror. And 11/11 originally meant armistice.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Jeanette. And we'll find a link about the Denis Kucinich event Sunday, 3 o'clock at the Women's Building in San Francisco. And we'll put a link at yourcallradio.org. Thank you so much for calling in. You can call us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We've got an email from a listener, Reese. Has Iraq's oil been privatized?
No, although that wasn't for lack of trying. The it's a bit complicated, so walk with me on this one.
Okay.
The U.S. and some elements within the Baghdad government wanted to change their basic oil law, which would have allowed privatization of new oil fields, not the old ones, but new ones. That was not passed. Meanwhile, in the northern part of Iraq, in the Kurdish region, the Kurdish regional government has gone ahead and signed its own contracts with oil companies on a privatization scheme. They're basically foreign oil companies put up the money, they develop the fields and profit from it, and the Iraqi government, or sorry, the Kurdish government gets a portion of that. But it's a boondoggle for the Kurdish government and for the Kurdish and for the oil companies up there. So one of the things to keep your eye on is, as the fighting intensifies, will the Kurdish region go independent and take these favorable contracts with the oil companies with them, much to the consternation of Baghdad?
All right. Thank you for that email. And I should also say that Reese wrote a piece for Truth Dig recently, 10 Myths About Obama's Latest War. You can find that at our website. You were in northern Iraq at the start of the U.S. bombing campaign against ISIS, and you interviewed Kurdish leaders, Peshmerga fighters, and U.S. officials. And you say that the reality on the ground is far different from what we're hearing from the White House.
Yes, partly we're getting the rah-rah propaganda about how well the war is going. In fact, you can't possibly win a war of this kind with air strikes alone. And what's the fundamental contradiction in both Iraq and Syria is, who's going to take over the towns and the cities and the villages, even if somehow the U.S. is able to drive out the Islamic State with airstrikes? And the answer is, with the exception of the Kurdish region, where the Peshmerga might be able to do that, there's nobody. In Iraq, there is no functioning Iraqi army. Even the most optimistic predictions say it's going to take months, if not years. In Syria, it's even worse. The U.S. has now officially given up on the Free Syrian Army. Remember the moderate elements of the rebels that we were supporting all these years? They're now admitted that they're no longer arming them, and they're going to create a new force, but that might take a year or more. So in the meantime, who the heck is going to be fighting on the ground? It's so obviously a losing strategy. It's hard to believe that these folks are going along with it, but so far they're still optimistic and claiming they're doing fine.
You write that in your interviews inside Syria and neighboring countries, Syrian rebels and opposition activists made clear they opposed the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Washington's total support for Israel. You write, every Syrian I ever met wants Israel to return the Golan Heights seized in 67, for example, but the U.S. is not interested in having this discussion.
Yeah, the U.S. is caught in a bind, which is, in the old days, we could invade and occupy a country and kind of force people to go along, or maybe these people would, because they wanted to be on the winning side. So you had Iraq and Afghanistan as two recent examples. But the empire is very much weakened now. We can't afford, monetarily, we can't afford yet another war of occupation. As it is, this war is costing $10 million a day, folks. You know, because we don't need that for health care or education or other things. We need it to for more war, right? $10 million a day, over $6 billion a year at a minimum. So the U.S. can't wage another war of occupation. So, but it wants to find supporters on the ground. The problem is when the U.S. comes in and says, oh, we're for free elections and democracy and
human rights
and independent judiciary and free markets, the local folks go, huh? Where exactly did any of this work in Iraq or Afghanistan? And while you're at it, why aren't you doing something about Israelis' occupation of the Golan Heights and the oppression of the Palestinians? So the U.S. policy is fundamentally at odds, and of course it'll be able to buy some or coerce some into supporting its policies, but it's not going to be able to put together a coalition to come to power in Damascus, or for even Baghdad, for that matter, that's sufficiently pro-U.S. to be able to call this a victory.
We have another caller. Let's go to William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate very much what Mr. Ehrlich has said. Just in a previous call, a caller mentioned that Denis Kucinich was coming to speak on a tour. And then I said to myself, you know, I really have enough information. I don't need any more information. I need to know what to do. And I was wondering whether Mr. Ehrlich had any ideas about what we could do, either that he had developed himself or that people might have brought to his attention when he did present analyses in various venues.
Very good question. And, of course, I have, being so profound, I have all the answers. I think it's important that there be an anti-war movement built from the grassroots up. And I know some groups have tried this, peace and justice groups, campus groups, and others. The demonstrations have been small so far, I think largely because people are so appalled by the beheadings and the horrific actions of the Islamic State that are not yet ready to come out in significant numbers to protest. But I think that will change as people become aware of the cost of the war, as the number of U.S. casualties mount, as civilian casualties mount. And we've seen this with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. Public opinion changes. So write letters, hold vigils, hold rallies, demonstrations, put the pressure on Washington to end the bombing.
We actually got an email from Joseph last week about this because President Obama was in the Bay Area and Southern California raising money. And he says, I have to wonder what's up when only about 100 people show up to meet and greet the President of the United States.
How much money do those 100 have?
Well, I think he was talking about the protesters outside.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's true. The demonstrations so far have been small. No question about it.
All right. Well, thank you, William. We have time for one more call. Let's go to Eric in San Francisco. Hi, Eric.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much. You know, I wanted to mention, I sent you an email about this, Rose, that, you know, Maliki, the Sunnis were brought back into the government under the Sunni Awakening, and the U.S. was paying them, and then Maliki stopped paying them and alienated them. And Obama has a real, Obama had a lot to do with this because when he had Maliki at the White House, they didn't put any pressure on Maliki to stop alienating the Sunnis, which had a lot to do with the whole thing exploding, right, and the Sunnis being sympathetic to ISIS. Thank you.
Yeah, keep in mind that Nouri al-Maliki, the former prime minister of Iraq, was handpicked by the United States. He was a little-known politician. He was the then U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Zalmay Khalilzad, personally selected him to be the prime minister, and he carried out U.S. policies during the time of the U.S. occupation of Iraq. So now the U.S. is turning around and saying, oh my God, it was all his fault that he alienated the Sunnis. Those policies had started long ago. And the new guy that is taking over, Al-Khadr, is, so far at least, not doing any better in terms of the war has to be won politically if you're going to defeat Islamic State. And that means building up Sunni allies in the areas where Islamic State is strong and using those allies to defeat the Islamic State on their own turf. And so far, the current government in Baghdad ain't doing that.
Well, thank you, Eric. We have an email from Carol. She sent over a graphic from The Economist showing why a coherent foreign policy in the Middle East is impossible. What are your thoughts on that, Reese? We have about
I can't see the graphic, but
it's just a mess. It's basically photos of sort of friendly, neutral countries, and it's just all over the board.
Yeah, no, it is very complicated. As I mentioned, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict plays a role in this. Mm-hmm. If suddenly tomorrow the U.S. played a strong role in resolving that struggle, it would do more to stop the Islamic State than all the bombs dropped to date and in the future. Why? Because if Israel and Palestine were living in peace next to each other, economically viable, politically viable, as unlikely as that sounds at the moment, but it is possible, that would undermine all the recruitment efforts, all the propaganda by these extremist groups who claim they're fighting U.S. imperialism and Zionism, blah, 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 who are not. It would dry up their support, or to do a lot to help dry up their support.
Do you think that's the number one issue here? Or one of the top
issues? Well, it's certainly one of the top issues.
Yeah.
Obviously, there are issues in Iraq and Syria that are not directly connected to Israel and Palestine, but that would go a long way to helping.
Where do you think that things will get worse before they get better?
Probably. Mainly, I'm optimistic in the medium and the long. I'm in the medium and the long run, but pessimistic in the short run, because it doesn't look like the U.S. is going to stop bombing. The U.S. bombing increases support for Islamic State by helping them recruit and claim the mantle of anti-imperialism. And I think it's going to be worse in the short run.
And the commander of U.S. military forces just this morning said it's highly possible that Kobani could fall to ISIS.
Yeah, I take all of those analyses with a grain of salt, because this morning's Wall Street Journal and New York Times report how well they're doing in stopping this
Islamic
State.
Well, that's what they
said
last night.
Yeah, and I think they don't know. Hmm. That's what it comes down to. And that confusion is then transmitted to the media, who dutifully report it.
What's your next piece? Your last one was 10 myths about Obama's latest war. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm doing a lot of I'm starting an East Coast book tour in a week and a half. I have some articles about that are related to my book, dealing with what did Lawrence of Arabia really do in Arabia during the World War I, some other fun things.
And the book is Inside Syria by Reese Ehrlich. And Reese will be at an event tonight with musicians to pay tribute to the people of Syria, Freight and Salvage in Berkeley at 8 o'clock. Find information at yourcallradio.org. Reese, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we're continuing our discussion about how the pro-choice movement should reframe the abortion debate. The Nation columnist Katha Pollitt will join us in studio to talk about her new book, Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights. 40 years after the landmark Roe v. Wade ruling, abortion is still a word that is said with hostility, and more than 200 state laws have passed to restrict abortion access in recent years. So how would you reframe abortion? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.